Hosea chapter 12. Now, at a first reading, the 12th chapter of Hosea, it seems to be a reversal to the rather sharp and severe spirit of the previous chapters. You may recall that chapter 11 was all about the loving kindness and the tenderness of God for his people. And the whole ethos and atmosphere of the 11th chapter is fragrant with the grace of the gospel of Christ. And in a sense, that 11th chapter, in all its sweetness and its beauty, seemed to be giving a promise of likely and hopeful things to come. And yet here in chapter 12, it seems, superficially at least, that Hosea is back again to the old hard words of judgment. You can see some of them, for example, in verse 2, the Lord has an indictment against, or as the Hebrew can read, the Lord has a bone to pick with Judah. He is going to punish Jacob according to his ways and requite him according to his deeds. The old word of judgment. You find it again in verse 7, where the people of God are called Canaanites, pagans, in whose hands are false balances they love to oppress. At the end of verse 8, God says, all your money can never buy back the guilt you have incurred in the acquisition of your riches, and so on. It seems as if chapter 12 is going to be another chapter about the judgments of God. But to read chapter 12 in this way is in fact to misread it and to misunderstand the whole feeling that lies behind the chapter. You see, chapter 12 is a direct continuation of chapter 11. And in fact, in the original text, there is no chapter division. There's no division between the message of chapter 11 and chapter 12. The whole thing just rushes through, and it's a continuation of the same message in chapter 11. And what you see here in the 12th chapter is love breaking through. If you cast back your mind to chapter 11, you may recall that there are three vivid and unforgettable pictures there of the love of God. In the first three verses, there is the picture of the loving father teaching his child how to walk and holding his bairn by the oxters and waddling the child across the room and holding him by the arms. Chapter 11 and verse 1. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. Verse 3. It was I who taught Ephraim how to walk. I took him by the arms, or as we say in the Scots, I held him by the oxters. And then when the child tumbles, they did not know that it was I who healed them after they fell and hurt themselves. The second picture in verse 4 is the picture of the loving farmer at the end of the day taking the bit from the beast's mouth and taking off the hard yoke from the beast's shoulders after a day's hard work. And in verse 4, God says, I led them with cords of compassion, or as the Hebrew says, I led them with the cords of a man, with the bands of love. Think of the bridle and the ropes on horses. I led them with the cords of a man, with the bands of love, and I became to them as someone who eases the yoke from their jaws, their sore jaws, at the end of the day, and I bent down, the loving farmer, I bent down to them, and I fed them. The third picture in verse 8 is of the loving husband who refuses to let his erring and his wayward wife go in spite of all her provocations. Hosea, you remember, was married to a very difficult woman, and God was also married to a very difficult nation, and the parallel holds. And so the husband says to his wife in verse 8, "How can I give you up?" God is speaking, "O Ephraim, how can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim?" The two cities of the plain that were destroyed, along with Sodom and Gomorrah. "My heart, at the very thought of giving you up, recoils within me, and my compassion, at the very thought of you, grows warm and tender, and so I will not execute my fierce anger against my bride. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not man." The loving father walking his bairn by the oxters. The loving farmer easing the bit and the yoke from his tired beasts. And the loving husband taking back his wife again and again. This is how much God loves you. This is what God does for sinners. This is how much God cares for you. And chapter 12 is a continuation of that. Chapter 12 is this kind of love breaking through for sinners. Love breaking through. That's the theme of chapter 12. I recall a great passage in one of C.S. Lewis's books, which I read a number of years ago. I think it's from his fine book, The Problem of Pain, in which he points out at the start of the book that pain is only a problem if God is love. If God is not love, then pain is not a problem. If God is a tyrant or a monster or some kind of ghastly, vindictive kind of God, then pain and sickness and death are not problems. That's the sort of thing you would expect from that kind of God. But because God is love, pain is a problem. And in the course of the book, C.S. Lewis says that, first of all, when life is ticking along quietly, and when there's nothing much going wrong and we don't have any problems, then God is whispering to you. So much so that when the going is good in most of our lives, we can hardly hear God speaking at all, because he is whispering to us when things are going fine. But secondly, when life is beginning to get a bit sticky and tacky, and when there is the odd worry and the odd problem and the odd care and the occasional nagging doubt, God is not whispering to you now. God is speaking to you. And if you listen, you will hear him. But thirdly, when disaster strikes, and when your world starts falling about you, and when the foundations of your life are shaken, and when the roof gives way, and the tide starts rising, and you are almost engulfed, God is no longer whispering, and he's no longer speaking. God is now shouting at you. In the ordinary, God whispers. In troubles, God speaks. in disaster, God is shouting. And that, to me, seems a very fair way of describing our human situation. For a great deal of our lives, many people are not aware of God speaking to them because he is whispering. Sometimes we are so busy and so taken up with ourselves and with our ploys and with our ventures that we can hardly hear the voice of God. Sometimes he whispers, sometimes he speaks, and sometimes he shouts at you. But the point that C.S. Lewis is making is this, that God is always trying to reach you, all the time, in all sorts of ways. God is besieging your heart and your life. Can I just change the imagery here and go to John Bunyan in his great book, The Holy War? You may recall that in The Holy War, there's a city which is under siege. It's the city of Mansoul. And it has been taken captive by an enemy. And the real king of Mansoul has been thrown out. And all the king's representatives in Mansoul, they've also either been thrown out or else they've been bought over and corrupted. Lord will, the feelings, the emotions, Lord understanding, they are now captive to the new tyrant in Mansoul. And so the city of Mansoul is in bondage and wretchedness to these new lords. But Mansoul has five gates. Ear gate and eye gate and mouth gate and nose gate and touch gate. And the king of Mansoul has a son, and he is called Emmanuel. And Emmanuel starts to besiege Mansoul in an attempt to capture Mansoul back for its true king. And so the Holy War by John Bunyan tells of the siege of the city. And the most important gate in Mansoul is Ear Gate. And this is how Emmanuel gets into Mansoul. This is how Emmanuel is trying to reach you right now. He is besieging Ear Gate right now. And he's trying to reach your heart and your soul. And so in the story we read of how Emmanuel prepares a great battering ram at Ear Gate, a vast beam of wood. And on this battering ram are carved the words, "Ye must be born again." And the soldiers take the ram and they batter Ear Gate again and again and again. And it seems as if nothing will shift the gate. But on they go with the ram. "Ye must be born again. Ye must be born again." And the point is well made by John Bunyan, that although the chief gate into Mansoul is Ear Gate, all the time and in all sorts of ways, Emmanuel is trying to reach you, and he's trying to get in and take you and repossess you for his Father. Love breaking through and love breaking in. And that's the theme of Hosea chapter 12. There are no two doubts, if you look briefly at the chapter, no two doubts as to what Emmanuel is trying to break into here in chapter 12. Can I just pick out three of the things which form the dark background to love breaking through? All of them are dreadfully contemporary and applicable to us today and to the sort of society in which we live. First of all, there's dark backcloth. There is a preoccupation with vanity. In the first half of the first verse, Ephraim herds the wind and pursues the east wind all day long. One of the translators, I think it's J.B. Phillips, translates at the first line, Ephraim rounds up the wind. And it's the picture of a cowboy rounding up the cattle and locking them in the corral. Well, there's futility and emptiness for you. Imagine chasing the wind and trying to round it up and lock it in for the night. Ephraim rounds up the wind and pursues the east wind all day long. And there's a good deal of that around these days in our society and in men's lives, chasing wind and being taken up with vanity and with emptiness. New clothes forever and ever and ever. Even when people don't really need more clothes, they go and buy more clothes. Vacant and unprofitable holidays, which are anything but a recreation. People come home exhausted from Mallorca. And very expensive holidays into the bargain. What about all the expensive cosmetics, which have all to be sadly washed off at the end of the day? I was appalled this week that when appeals for Ethiopia were coming through the post, glossy brochures from the stores were also coming through the post, speaking about the most outrageously expensive perfumes that you might buy your friends for Christmas. Costly perfumes, and not to miss the point, costly aftershave lotions, luxury foods that have almost become necessity foods. Surely you must know that our society today is run by Gentiles, to whom all these things are the very essence of good living. And this is what their life is like. They are rounding up the wind. They are chasing wind and emptiness. And I'm sure that one of the things that we need to be saved from as contemporary Christians, and I do preach to myself as well as to others, is this dreadful longing for the temporary. This constant preoccupation with the superficial and the trashy and the brief and the empty. Things that don't last. And personally speaking, I do find that the older I get, the more and more interested I am in the permanent. Something that's going to last. And especially something that's going to last after I die. You know this nightmare vision that I have? It's a nightmare that recurs, of walking across a beach, and at the end of the beach, turning to look back, and not seeing any footprints on the sand, as if I had never existed, and had done nothing for God, and nothing for Christ, in the course of my life. Paul says, writing in the New Testament to some of the early Christians, he says, you know that you were saved from the futile traditions which you inherited from your fathers. And I'm sure that salvation from futility and emptiness and a preoccupation with vanity is a major part of the salvation we need in Jesus Christ. Ephraim herds the wind and pursues the east wind all day long. The second part of this dark backcloth is found in the second half of that verse. The last two lines where Hosea speaks about Israel making a bargain with Assyria and oil being carried down as a tribute to Egypt. You see, Israel, geographically speaking, was always in a very difficult position because Israel was a kind of meat in a sandwich away up in the north. Assyria was threatening. And away down in the south, Egypt was doing the same. Now, Assyria and Egypt were great empires compared to Israel. And Israel was always sandwiched between these great empires. And there was always the temptation to buy off the enemy and to make covenants and bargains with Assyria and to make bargains with Egypt in the south and pour tribute upon Egypt. And of course, like all bribes and tributes, the end of Israel was worse than the first because the demands just went on and on and on, like blackmail money, moral blackmail. Assyria pressing down, Egypt pressing up, and Israel frantically trying to buy off the evil day and buy off the enemy with money. And there is in many of us, you know, a tendency to buy off problems and to pay the money and to pay what is asked in the belief that when the money is given, the problem will go away. I'm sure that that's how many people avoid the awful pain that there is in the world today when it comes to giving to charity and to urgent causes, like the Ethiopian appeal for the famine victims, or when the Red Cross comes round, or it may be Oxfam, or it may be Christian Aid, or it may be Tear Fund. I wonder if you feel in yourself what I sometimes feel in myself, a little bit guilty that when I put the collection in, I'm really buying myself out of another kind of commitment. In other words, and the words of Eric Crozier, we pour out our treasures to bribe distress. I wonder if I can read you some words by Eric Crozier. They were used by Benjamin Britten in his lovely cantata, the St. Nicholas cantata. And St. Nicholas, the Bishop of Smyrna, beg your pardon, Bishop of Myra, is preaching to sinner man about his need for repentance. And Eric Crozier puts these lovely words into the mouth of St. Nicholas, Santa Claus as he became, these lovely words. O man, the world is set for you as for a king. Paradise is yours in loveliness. The stars shine down for you. For you the angels sing. Yet you prefer your wilderness. You hug the rack of self. You embrace the lash of sin. You pour your treasures out to bribe distress. And that's the point where I feel guilty. If I put in a check, or a £5 note, or a £10 note, sometimes I feel that that is a substitute for some other kind of personal commitment. Did you know that there is now enough money in Fort Knox, in America, to solve the world's problems right now? Did you know that in the Bank of England's reserves, there is enough money to solve the problems of the world's poverty right now, this very night? Did you know there is enough money in the Vatican to solve all the problems of the world's poverty? Tonight, in one night, the Pope could end the problems of world poverty. Of course, it's essential that we give, and give generously. It's essential that the money should keep coming. It would be hard for many folk to put £10 into a tear fund box. It would be harder still for them to come to a tear fund prayer group. And it might be even harder still to go out into the third world and give your life to helping the poor through tear fund. You see, sometimes we do use our treasures to bribe distress in the hopes that Assyria will go away or Egypt will go away. Here's the money. Go away. We use our treasures to bribe distress. And of course, it's not the answer. They make a bargain with Assyria, and tribute is carried down to Egypt. And the third part of the darker backcloth of this chapter is very briefly the problem of wealth. And you find it in verse 8. Ephraim has said, "Ah, that's all very impressive, but I am rich. I have gained wealth for myself." I wonder if you noticed the self-centeredness of those words as we read them. Ephraim has said, "Ah, but I am rich. I have gained wealth for myself." Almost as if he had never read that verse in Deuteronomy, which says that it is the Lord God who gives us power to get wealth. It's the attitude of the prodigal, you see. I am rich. I have gained wealth for myself. And the second half of verse 8 has the implication in it that all that wealth has been acquired at the expense of others. God says to this rich nation, all his riches can never offset the guilt he has incurred. The riches have been acquired at the expense of others. And I think that rings true to reality. If you know anything of history on the broad scale and think back to the great empires of Assyria and of a golden Babylon and of Rome in its immensity, of the great Russian Empire, of the Tsars, of the great Spanish Empire stretching into South America, virtually all that wealth was built on human misery, the downtrodden poor, and the serfs and the slaves, and the people at the bottom of the imperial heap who were robbed and raped and looted and pillaged to make the empires great. And although one does not like to think of these things, even the British Empire, whatever good we may have been able to do in the world by the way of bringing law and order into primitive societies, the British Empire was undoubtedly built on suppression and repression, cheap sugar and cheap rubber and cheap tea and cheap coffee and cheap wood and cheap wheat. And all of these came from our empire, and they were produced by the poor at the bottom of the imperial heap. I wonder just how much we accumulated guilt on the way. All his riches can never offset the guilt he has incurred. Ephraim says, "Oh, but I'm rich. I've gained wealth for myself." But all his riches, says God, can never offset the guilt he incurred in the acquisition of his wealth. And it's against this dark background, the interest in vanity and futility, herding the wind like a cowboy trying to put the cattle into a corral, bribing the enemy and the problems in the hopes that they'll go away. The difficulties and the guilt created by wealth. It's into this dark background that love comes breaking through, because the real heart of this chapter is not the problems and the darkness. The real heart of this chapter is the story of Jacob in verses 3 to 5 and verse 12. And the story of Jacob is the story of the love of God breaking through into man's life. We can think of four ways in which the love of God did that for Jacob, and in which the love of God can do that for you this evening. First of all, love breaking through before you were born. Secondly, love breaking through in the message of grace. Thirdly, love breaking through in an overruling providence. And fourthly, love breaking through in the revelation of your true self. First of all, then, love breaking through before you were born. Look at verse 3. In the womb of Rebekah, Jacob took his brother Esau by the heel. There was, as Genesis says, describing the story of Rebekah's pregnancy, there was a battle going on inside her between the twins before they were born. And behind that battle in Rebekah's womb, there was the electing grace and love of God. Before Jacob was born, the love of God lighted on him in his mother's womb. And that was why he wrestled with his twin brother Esau. The destiny of God was on him. His destiny was on him before he was born. If you know the letter to the Romans, you'll know that this is something that Paul brings out in Romans chapter 9, where he's dealing with the problem of the gospel mystery of predestination. And he says, what is it that lies behind predestination? Does God choose us because we love him? Does God choose us because we trust him? Does God choose us because we are good and righteous and virtuous? Does God choose us because we are promising? Does God choose us because our father was a Christian, or our mother was a Christian, or your granny was a Christian, or your great-grandfather was a Christian? What lies behind predestination? And this great ninth chapter of Romans, Paul says, electing grace, the love of God lighting on a sinner's life, is something that transcends, first of all, blood. It transcends blood relationships. Isaac was chosen, Paul says, and not Ishmael. Now they were brothers, and they had the same father. They had different mothers, of course, but they had the same father. The blood of Abraham was in Isaac's veins, and the blood of Abraham was also in Ishmael's veins. But the love of God transcends blood. And Isaac was chosen, and Ishmael was bypassed. Secondly, Paul says, the electing love and grace of God is something that transcends morality, even. I suppose if you were confronted with Jacob and Esau, you would choose Esau, because Esau was a far more attractive person than Jacob. Jacob was a scoundrel. He was a confidence trickster. He was a gangster. He was an absolute rogue. Jacob, Esau was easygoing, hail fellow, well met. He was a country boy. He was out in the fields, and he came home and enjoyed a hearty meal. A very attractive, earthy sort of man. And yet, the love of God transcends morality. And Jacob the scoundrel was chosen, and Esau was bypassed. And thirdly, Paul says in Romans 9, the love of God transcends natural rights, because Esau was born first of the twins, and the firstborn had the rights of primogeniture, as they're called. He was the head of the family when his father died. And in Esau's case, Esau could have been the forerunner of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, because that's how the line ran. But although Esau was born first, Jacob was treated as the firstborn. You see, the love of God and the electing grace of God transcends blood and morality and natural rights. Now think of that in relation to yourself. If you have come to Jesus Christ, before you were born, God's high purpose was on you. God's destiny for you was on you. And His love laid hold of you before you were born. In the womb, Jacob took his brother Esau by the heel. Before you are born, you belong to me. That's what Hosea is saying. They shall be mine in the day when I make up my jewels. This one, and that one, and the other one. Before you are born, mine, says God. You belong to me before you are born. Love breaks in to your life in what the fathers used to call prevenient grace. Grace coming beforehand. Now, of course, after you are born, you still have to come to Christ. You have to come in repentance and faith and response to Jesus Christ. But you're coming to Christ in repentance and response and in faith is only possible because of prevenient grace working before you were born. Love breaks through before you're born. In the womb, Jacob took his brother Esau by the heel. Secondly, love breaks through in the message of grace. Look at verse 4 in the second half. He met God at Bethel, and there God spoke with him. You know that the two highlights in Jacob's life are Bethel and Peniel. These are the two mountain peaks in his life. And they were separated by 20 years away up in the north with Laban, his uncle. He was looking for a wife and landed with Leah and Rachel, and a mare's nest of problems as well. Bethel and Peniel, separated by 20 years. Now, the point of Bethel is this, that Jacob learned at Bethel that God is a God who comes down to man's level. You remember how he fell asleep with a stone for his pillow and a guilty conscience nagging inside him because he was running away from his brother Esau and the terrible thing he'd done to his brother, robbing him of his birthright and of his blessing, and fleeing from his brother and fleeing from God. And he lies on the ground with the stone for his pillow, and then he dreams his famous dream, the ladder from heaven to earth, and the angels of God ascending and descending. Now, you understand, it's not a ladder like our ladder. Some of the scholars say that it's a staircase, or perhaps one of the ziggurats from Babylon, the great mounds with the stairs going up. After all, angels could not ascend and descend one of our ladders. Be a bit of a crush, don't you think? Angels all on the one ladder. A kind of staircase from heaven to earth with the angels. And the message of the staircase was this. God didn't ask him to climb up. And God doesn't ask you to climb up. You don't need to climb up to reach God. You cannot climb up to reach God. It's God who comes down to you and your level. Love breaks through into your heart in the message of sovereign grace. This is something that Moses brings out very beautifully in Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 12, I think, where people are tempted to struggle to find God in their own strength and, as we say nowadays, work their own passage to heaven, work their fingers to the bone, do things for God and do things for Christ and hope that in the end of the day everything's going to come all right because they'll have worked their passage to heaven. But Moses says in Deuteronomy 30, and actually Paul quotes it again in Romans chapter 10, he says, "Do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven to bring Christ down? For the righteousness which comes from faith says this, the word is near you, even on your lips." God is near you because he comes down to your level. God is available. Love comes down the ladder, down the staircase, and love breaks into your poor life in the grace of the gospel. The staircase comes down from heaven to you. Love breaks through in the message of grace. Thirdly, love breaks through in an overruling providence. Look at the 12th verse, describing the period between Bethel and Peniel. 20 years. Jacob fled to the land of Aram in the north, and there he did service for a wife, and for a wife he shepherded sheep. And that one verse really sums up the 20 years of backsliding and a disaster between Bethel and Peniel. When Jacob was up in the north working for his uncle, setting his eye on Rachel because she was lovely, but being married off somewhat deceitfully to Leah, he got the shock when she lifted her veil and he discovered he was married to the wrong sister. And so he had to go back to the fields and work for another 7 years for the sister he really loved. But you see, for those 20 years, Jacob was off the rails. After the message of grace at Bethel, sovereign grace coming down, he was still running his own life. And he was still doing things his own way. A recipe for disaster, to do things your own way. And it certainly was a disaster, because after he was married to these two ladies, Rachel and Leah, when he traveled south again, of course, he took his wives with him, and then the hate campaign started in the house and the jealousy. There were Leah's children. There was Rachel's barrenness. All that dreadful spite and the malice between these two ladies, each one trying to be one up on the other one, each one trying to love the husband and get the husband's life better than the other one. And all that mess was the fruit of his backsliding and his drifting from God. And yet, the love of God in an overruling providence broke through the mess and overruled the mistakes and forgave him. And in fact, it was out of all that mess that there came two of the leading characters in Old Testament history. One was Levi, the father of the priests, who pointed forward to Jesus Christ, the great high priest. And the second great character who came out of that mess was Judah, the father of the kings, who paved the way for the coming of Jesus Christ the King. Have you ever thought of the awful mistakes you've made in life? Have you thought of the disasters and the messes and the mismanagements and the snarls? God can overrule these, and love can break in with providence and overrule the disasters and convert them to blessing, as God did in Aram for Jacob. Jacob fled to Aram, and there he did service for a wife, for two wives, and for a wife he herded sheep. It was a disaster area, but God overruled it in his providence, and love broke through. And lastly, love breaks through in the revelation of your true self. If you look at the end of verse 3 and the start of verse 4, in his manhood, Jacob wrestled with God. He wrestled with the angel of the covenant, and he prevailed, and he wept and sought the angel's blessing. And the reference here is to the second great experience, the experience of Peniel, when he met the angel of the covenant and wrestled with him all night. And you remember, in the middle of this wrestling match, he asks the angel what his name is, and the angel declines to give Jacob his name. And the angel says to Jacob, "And just by the way, what is your name?" And of course, he had to confess his real name, which is Jacob, which means a twister.